Take your Bibles, if you will, and turn to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. Names have always been interesting things to me. When I was born, my maternal grandmother gave my father a choice of two different names to give me. He had, up to this point, been using his or his brother's names in almost every one of his children. I have five older brothers, so there has been a lot of repetition to that point. And so my grandmother gave him the choice between Charles Andrew and Joseph Zachary. I thought for most of my childhood that I would have rather have had Joseph Zachary than Charles Andrew. I thought Charles was too grown up of a name and would have rather been called Zach or something along those lines. That is why when I was in year 7, I changed my name, not officially in any sense, but I told people to start calling me Chuck, because Charles seemed too old for me, and I have been Chuck ever since. When I am meeting new people or being introduced to someone, and someone introduces me as Chuck, people know right away that I'm American. Chuck is not a very British name. And so people will just recognize that right off of the bat. The reason I say this is because names in Scripture are very important. Names are given because of the meanings that those names have. They convey something about the individual who has been given the name. You think of Jacob. It means supplanter. Well, he was given that name because he was doing that even in the womb. And it was true throughout his life as well. I think of the name Emmanuel, meaning God with us. That was told in the book of Isaiah that it was going to be the Messiah's name, Emmanuel. It should have been a hint to the Jews that the Messiah wasn't going to be just the king. He was going to be God with us because of the meaning of the name. They missed that. The Jews, for the most part, missed that God was going to be incarnate in the flesh, in the Messiah. But one of the issues that we may have is that there are many names in the Scriptures given to God. And there are various meanings to those names. Meanings that can give comfort, meanings that can give strength, meanings that can give even trepidation, if we understood what those names were and what they mean and why they're used. And I think sometimes we miss those. We miss those just as the Jews missed what Emmanuel meant and signified. And so this morning, we are going to look at one of those names. It may be one that you have not heard before. It is the name El Roy, and it's spelled R-O-I, not R-O-Y. And El is a name for God, and it means the strong one. Roy, when it's attached to that, means the strong one who sees. The God who sees is the meaning of the name. And so we're going to look at some scriptures that show us why he was called that. And hopefully we can learn some things from those scriptures. Psalm 139, the passage that I read, does not necessarily use that name. And it's not going to be my main text, but it gives you a clue as to what God does see. And so I'm going to read that again, and I just want you to think about the name of God, the God who sees, as I read this text. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down-sitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning, and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lower parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men, for they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. That psalm is a beautiful psalm, and indeed it actually gives us the omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience of God all in that one psalm, meaning that God is all-powerful, God is all-knowing, and God is always present. And so this afternoon we're going to look at some things about the God who sees. As he does in this psalm, he sees everything about us. He saw everything about us before we were even formed. He knew us intimately. The first time that this name for God, the God who sees, is used is in Genesis chapter 16. Genesis chapter 16, and it's used by an unlikely source. If you recall, Abraham had been called out of Ur of the Chaldees. He had taken Lot and his wife Sarai and his father, and they had gone to Haran. And when his father died in Haran, he had moved on to the land of Canaan, and he had been there for over 10 years, and yet had no children, even though God had promised to give him the land, and that all nations of the earth would be blessed through him. And so Sarai, she has yet have her name changed to Sarah, has been getting anxious. She has passed the time in life where she could bear children, and so she goes to Abram and says, I can't bear children anymore. I want you to go in under my handmaid Hagar and have a child with her, and then I'll call that child mine. And that's the way that this promise will be fulfilled. And as it is with most of the times when we try and fulfill the Lord's promises ourselves, we mess things up. The Lord will fulfill his own promises. He does not need our help. He may use us as he sees fit, but he certainly doesn't need us to figure out how to fulfill those things. And so Abram goes into Hagar, and she conceives and has become pregnant. And she gets very proud of this fact. And she starts to mock Sarai, and Sarai gets upset and goes to Abram and says, look what has been done. In verse 5 of chapter 16 it says, and Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid unto thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress, Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress, and submit thyself unto her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his children. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, that thou God seest me. For she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore the well was called Beer Lahairoi, because it is between Kadesh and Bered. And so the first time the name is used, it's used by Hagar. A surprising character, not someone that you would have thought calling God something that had such an impact. But she uses this name because God has seen her affliction. She was treated poorly by Sarai. And she's in the wilderness with nothing. She flees. She has no provisions. And God comes, sends the angel of the Lord to her and says, you're going to be all right. I've seen what's happened. I've seen what's going to take place. I'm going to bless you. And the child that you're going to have is going to be the father of nations. He's going to have many children. And they're going to have many children. And you're going to be blessed through this. And she says, I'm amazed. Because you've seen what is going on in my life. And Hagar obeys the Lord. She goes back to Sarai and submits to Sarai. And she submits for the next 12 to 13 years. Knowing that Ishmael is not going to be the heir to Abraham. And she submits, and then she's driven out again. Because this time, it's not Hagar that's mocking, it's actually Ishmael that's mocking Isaac. And they are pushed out, and they're in the wilderness, in the desert, and she makes Ishmael go lay under a bush, because she figures we're both going to die. And she goes a space away because she doesn't want to see her son die. She may have forgotten the promise of the Lord at that point, and the Lord appears to her again. And says, I've seen the boy. And he uses the name that Hagar had given to him. And says, I am the God that sees. I know exactly what's going on in your life, and I am still going to bless you. That hasn't changed. Your circumstances may have changed, but I haven't. And that's something that we can take comfort in. That's something that we can be comforted through, the idea that God sees. It means that He comforts us. He knows our affliction. He knows what goes going on in our lives. In Genesis chapter 31, the name is used again. This time by another character, and I say character in the sense that he is a character, it's Jacob, the supplanter. And if you recall the story of Jacob, he has worked for his wives. He has worked 7 years for his wife, Rachel. He was then tricked into marrying Leah instead. He works another 7 years for his wife, Rachel. And then he works another 6 years for Laban, for his cattle. So he's worked for Laban for approximately 20 to 21 years that he's labored for his father-in-law. And he says, it's time to go. It's time to leave. It's time to go back to Canaan. It's time to go back to the land that has been promised to me from God. And he gathers together all his possessions. God has blessed him, and he leaves. And Laban gets upset. Laban gets angry at Jacob. And he goes and he tracks him down with his men. And he confronts him, and the pretext that he uses is the fact that his household gods had been stolen. So clearly you can see that Laban is not worshiping the true God. And he claims that his household gods have been stolen, and we find out that Rachel is the one who's actually stolen the household gods. And she's actually hiding them. And she deceives her father, and Laban is upset. And we find in verse 36, after Laban could not find those household gods, even though his daughter deceived him, that Jacob gets upset. And he says, and Jacob was wroth and chode with Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, What is my trespass? What is my sin that thou hast so hotly pursued after me? Whereas thou hast searched all my stuff, what hast thou found of all thy household stuff? Set it here before my brethren and thy brethren, that they may judge betwixt us both. This 20 years have I been with thee, thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten. That which was torn of beasts I brought not unto thee. I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was. In the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. Thus have I been 20 years in thy house. I have served thee 14 years for thy two daughters, and 6 years for thy cattle. And thou hast changed my wages 10 times. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away now empty. God hath seen mine affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked thee yesternight. Even through the midst of Jacob's deceptions, he was deceived multiple times himself by Laban, and his wages had been changed 10 times, he recognized something. That even in the midst of all of those things he did wrong, and the wrongs done to him, God saw his affliction. God saw how he was treated, and God was going to bless him in spite of who Jacob was. That is a comfort. It's a comfort to me to know that despite my failings, despite the things that I don't do right, despite the things that I don't do that I should do, and the things I don't do, the things I've messed myself up just like whenever I read that from Paul. The things I would do, I don't do. And the things I wouldn't do, I do. God still sees me. He sees me, though, differently. And He gives to me differently than what I deserve, just like He did for Jacob. He blesses because He sees our affliction. He sees our infirmities. Go over to Moses, Exodus chapter 3. If you recall the story of Moses, Moses was in Pharaoh's household. And Moses thought that he was going to be used by God. He was correct, but he was incorrect about the timing of it, wasn't he? And so he thought he was going to be used by God to rescue the Israelites out of Egypt. And so he rises up and he murders the Egyptian. And then he has to flee. And for 40 years he's on the backside of the desert. And he is toiling with sheep. And he probably thinks, there's nothing that God doesn't see anything. The Israelites have been here for hundreds of years. I thought I was going to be the one risen up to secure their release, and yet nothing has happened. What is God doing? Well, as he's there, he is going along with the sheep, and he sees on the mountain some smoke. He gets closer and he sees the fire, and it's the burning bush. And so he turns aside. He turns aside and he says, "What's going on? The bush is not being consumed." And God speaks to him, tells him to remove his sandals. In verse 6, it says, "Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites, and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites." In the midst of it all, Moses thought that God had forgotten. But in the midst of it all, what does God say? "No, I'm the God who sees. I know what's been taking place with my children. I've got it all under control. I've got it all planned out. I'm making them a great nation as they're being afflicted by the Egyptians. And I'm going to draw them out. I'm going to do it now. And I'm going to use you, despite what you thought before, despite what you thought for the past 40 years. I see these things." You see, God sees us where we are. He knows more about us than we know of ourselves. He knows, just as it says in Psalm 139, He knows my uprising, He knows my downsitting. He knows every intimate part of me. The Scripture tells us in the New Testament that He knows the hairs of my head or the lack thereof. It's amazing what God knows of me because He sees me. He sees me at all times. And unless you think this is just an Old Testament situation, in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, this is definitely a comfort to me as we are attempting to build an assembly in Harrogate, and hopefully is a comfort here as well. When you read Revelation 2 and 3, there is a pattern when Jesus is speaking to His churches. And I'm not going to read the entire chapters, but I want you to notice what the pattern is. Under the angel of the church of Ephesus, right in verse 1 of chapter 2, "These things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. I know thy works, and thy labor, and thy patience, and how thou canst not bear them which are evil." Jesus, as he speaks to each and every church, says the same thing. "I know thy works." How does he know those things? Because he sees them. He sees the effort. He doesn't judge upon whether we think we're successful or not. He doesn't judge upon if I've got 100 in the congregation, 500, 5,000, 100,000, or 5. He doesn't judge based off of that. He judges off of our heart. Because he sees my heart. He knows my heart. That's what he judges based off of. Success is left to him. We're always reminded of what Paul says. Apollos may have watered. He may have planted, Apollos has watered, but God gives the increase. I can't control how many people show up. I can't control how many people are saved. Those are God's issues. Success from the worldly mindset of how many people are sitting down in the assembly, then that's God's success, not our success. Our success should be rated more on the fact that Jesus knows our works. Jesus knows our efforts. Jesus knows what we're putting into something. What comes out of it is up to Him. What goes into it is up to us. How much effort are we putting in? And He knows it. And it should be a comfort to us that He knows it. Especially when you look around the country and you see small works everywhere. That there aren't large assemblies where there are a large gathering together of the Lord's people in the land today. And you say, why is that? I have no idea why it is. But I can say this, that God knows our works. He sees us. He sees the efforts we put in. Whether or not we think we're successful or not. He knows what's going on because He sees us. And that is the picture that John gives us in chapter 1 of Revelation. He's speaking about Jesus Christ. In verse 4 he says, John to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace be unto you and peace from Him which is, and which was, and which is to come, and from the seven spirits which are before His throne, and from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness, and the first begotten of the dead, and the prince of the kings of the earth, unto Him that loved us and washed us from our sins in His own blood. What did he call Jesus Christ? The faithful witness. What is a witness? It's someone who's seen something. It's someone who's seen what's been going on. Jesus Christ knows every single detail. When he ascended into heaven, it didn't mean that he couldn't see anymore. He has seen everything that has happened from that time to this time. And he knows it all. He's got perfect memory. He's got perfect knowledge. He's got perfect sight. And that should be a comfort to his people. It should be something that strengthens us and gives us hope. Because he knows and loves us regardless. Just like he did with Jacob. Just like he did with Hagar. Regardless of our circumstances. Regardless of what we've done to put ourselves in that circumstance. He sees it. He knows it. And he still loves you. If you're one of his. Now, the idea that God, the God who sees, the name of God, in that sense, the God who sees, yes, it's a cause for comfort, but it should also be a cause for trepidation. It should be a cause for a little bit of knee shaking. Because he sees all that goes on. In Jeremiah chapter 7, this is the name that is used here. Verses 1 through 16. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word, and say, hear the word of the Lord, all ye of Judah, that enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust ye not in lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. For if ye thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the stranger, nor the fatherless and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. Behold, ye trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will ye steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye know not? And come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations. Is this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. But go ye now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because ye have done all these works, saith the Lord, and I spake unto you, rising up early and speaking, but ye heard not, and I called you, but you answered not. Therefore will I do unto this house, which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight, as I have cast out all your brethren, even the whole seed of Ephraim. Therefore pray not thou for this people, neither lift up cry nor prayer for them, neither make intercession to me, for I will not hear it. I will not hear thee. This is a harsh word, isn't it? This is the word that came to Judah. This is the word that came to Judah after they had departed from God time and time and time again. And what does God say to them? He sees it. He sees what's going on. In verse 11, "Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord." They thought that they could actually go and sin and worship Baal and do all of these despicable things and come to God and say, "God, we didn't have a choice. We didn't have a choice. Our circumstances forced us into it. God, we're really worshiping and loving you." And on the outward, it looked that way. But God said, no, I've seen this. I've seen what's in your heart. I've seen the actions that you've performed, and I'm calling you for it. Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 11. Again, it continues the same theme. The writer says, "Hell and destruction are before the Lord. How much more then the hearts of the children of men?" You see, one of those things that the world gets wrong. They get this concept that in hell, Satan is going to be in charge, and he's going to be punishing people, and it's going to be kind of a free-for-all. No, God sees it, and God knows what's going on. Hell and destruction are before the Lord all of the time. Those things aren't out of his sight. They never will be out of his sight. And if those things aren't out of his sight, then the hearts of men are in his sight. He's the God who sees. He sees everything about us. He knows it all. Again, back in Jeremiah chapter 17. Jeremiah 17, and you'll forgive me for our turning, but I think it builds the proper picture. Verse 9, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. As the partridge sitteth on eggs and hatcheth them not, so he that getteth riches and not by right shall leave them in the midst of his days, and at his end shall be a fool." The fool has said it in his heart, "There is no God." That's what God is saying here. Yeah, I know your heart. It's deceitful and wicked above all things, and you can try and fool me, and all you're going to do is fool yourself. And in the end, be left with nothing. Because I know your heart. I see your heart. It has not escaped me. One of the awful situations that you can picture in the scriptures is in Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. You can recall many of the stories from Daniel. You think of him refusing the king's food. You think of him interpreting the king's dream. You think of the young men refusing to bow down to the idol. You think of Nebuchadnezzar as a wild animal. Sometimes we forget what happens in Daniel chapter 5. If you recall, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar is Belshazzar. And Belshazzar is king of Babylon. And he has no thought about God whatsoever, to the point where he is having a party. He's throwing a lavish banquet. And he calls for the vessels that were used in the temple to be brought. And they eat and drink off of these vessels. The holy things that were used for the worship of God have now been brought to be platters, to be cups and drinks for these men. And they knew exactly what it was, and they were mocking God by doing it. And all of a sudden, I've always kind of mocked the cliche, the writings on the wall, because people use it incorrectly. Because they say, "Oh, the writing's on the wall," which would be the mindset that there's something obvious here. Because when the writing was on the wall for Belshazzar, he didn't understand what it said. A hand appeared and wrote on the wall, and he couldn't make heads or tails of it. He couldn't figure out what it said. And so he called all the wise men in the kingdom, and they couldn't figure out what it said. And finally somebody said, "You know, there's one man that's been left over from from Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He's of the Jews. And in him is the spirit of wisdom. Maybe he can figure out what it says." And so Daniel comes. In verse 17 of chapter 5, "Then Daniel answered and said before the king," and this is, he is not shy about what he says here. Listen to it. "Let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom, and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was disposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointed over it whomsoever he will. And now, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. Now hast praised the gods of silver and gold and of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose all are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written. Many, many tikkel upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tikkel, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. God saw what he was doing. God knew what was going on in every way in Belshazzar's heart. And God comes to him through Daniel and says, you've been weighing the balances. I've seen what's been taking place, and you are found wanting. That is a wake-up call, isn't it? It should be a wake-up call for us, whether we're a Christian or whether we're not a Christian. It should be something that convicts us of our sin, that God knows us. God sees us. God sees our actions when no one else is looking. It used to be told to me that true character is what you do when no one's looking. Well, you can never have true character then, because there's always someone looking. God always sees. God always sees what's going on. God always sees what's going on the outside, and God always sees what's going on in the heart. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 11 to 13. How does God do this? How does God reveal to us today? Because he is not appearing as he did to Belshazzar. He's not sending his angel as he did to Hagar. He is not sending his angel as he did to Jacob. How does he reveal that to us today as we sit, as we're here listening? Hebrews chapter 4, verses 11 to 13. Let us labor therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief, speaking about the Israelites. For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Neither is there any creature that is not manifest in his sight, but all things are naked and opened under the eyes of him with whom we have to do. How does he do that? Through his word. Through his people. That's how God works. That's how God convicts. That's how God takes us from being a lost sinner without Christ and draws us to the Savior. He works through his Spirit, through his word, and reveals to us the things that we ought not to be doing, and reveals to us the things we ought to be doing, and shows us that God sees, that he is the God who sees. He sees all about us, and his word is quick and powerful and can discern your heart, because it belongs to God. His word belongs to God. Your heart belongs to God. And it's a comforting thing, but at the same time, something that makes me fear when it says, but all things are naked and opened under the eyes of him with whom we have to do. That's sobering. That's a sobering thought, to know that God sees me at all times. That God sees my heart at all times. That God sees my heart so much better than I do at all times. So the question then becomes, what about things like Revelation chapter 2 and 3? There's comfort there, but there's also that same sobering thought. Because Jesus says, I know thy works, But he gives us something to do, doesn't he? If you look in verse 7, and this is the same thing that follows in chapter 2 of Revelation. This is the same thing that follows after every letter. He starts off, he says, I know thy works, and he lists what they've done, good and bad. But then he says, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. And then he says, to him that overcometh, I will give this and this. To him that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. You hear that throughout the Scriptures. God sees. He is the God who sees. What should we do? Hear what he says. You hear that on the Mount of Transfiguration. This is my beloved Son. Hear ye him. You hear that in the book of Isaiah. Who am I going to send? You're going to go and they're not going to hear. He says that to Jeremiah. You're going to preach for your life through this to Jerusalem and to Judah. They're not going to listen to you. He says it in the Sermon on the Mount. Let him that hath an ear hear. Do you hear? Do you hear the fact that God sees? God sees everything within you. And so the final question becomes, what is asked in Psalm 139, where we began? Psalm 139, that beautiful psalm that tells us so much about God, so much about who He is, about His presence with us at all times, about His knowledge of us at all times. In verse 23, it says, Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. That is not an easy thing to say. That was not an easy thing for David to say. There had been times in his life when God had searched him out and found those wicked ways and purged those from him. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable to have your wickedness purged. It's revealed. It's brought out to light. Can you say that? Can you say to God, Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Because He is the God who sees. He is the God who sees all things. Everything is open to Him with whom we have to do. Nothing is hidden. Does that change how you go about your life? Does that change how you approach Jesus Christ? Does it give you comfort? I hope it does if you're a Christian. Does it give you trepidation? I certainly hope it does if you're not a Christian. Because God sees everything that you do. I hope it gives us trepidation even if we are a Christian. Because judgment starts with us. Purify ourselves through His Word. Because it's sharper than any two-edged sword. And ask God to search us. Can you do that? And will you do that? We point you to Christ.